This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
This is the Clusterfuck podcast. I am your personable host, Roger King. Well, the other big story in the U.S. besides the pandemic has obviously been this year's race protests after the police killing of George Floyd. It really does seem like we've reached a turning point and some kind of serious action will follow. I want to dive into all of that and much more with my guest today, including minority voting rights and, of course, the upcoming November election. She is a longtime activist and organizer, particularly in the U.S. South. She is a philanthropic consultant and political strategist, and if that isn't enough, also an accomplished jazz singer as well, a Renaissance woman. She is now a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and the co-founder of Black Voters Matter. Latosha Brown, welcome to Clusterfuck.
Thank you for having me here. I'm happy to be here today.
Well, let's dive right in. As I mentioned, the George Floyd protests off the top, they've been inspiring, I think, not just in the U.S., but all around the world. From my perspective, we've seen what appear to be, you know, galvanizing moments before, and then maybe we don't get the change we're hoping for. This one sort of feels a little different. Public opinion has moved in a huge way. You know, we have polls showing 70% of Americans support the protests, and anywhere from 60 to 65% of Americans support the Black Lives Matter movement. Does it feel to you like a turning point? And what do you expect in the short term will come out of this legislatively, assuming a Biden victory in November, of course?
So I think what we're all feeling, we all have to know that something is different. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we do know for sure is this is the largest multiracial, multigenerational uprising that has ever been in this country. There were uprisings in all 50 states. And when you looked at the front lines, you saw Black people and white people and Asian people and Latinx people and indigenous folks. The bottom line is that, you know, around this issue, I think it was just there's always like this turning point. It's like the tipping point,
right?
This tipping point of which is a defining moment around where people have just make a decision like, okay, something has to change. I think for us to literally witness, you know, this man lose his life, like literally see the life drain out of him by a white police officer who actually was so cavalier about it that he had his hands in his pockets, mm-hmm. even though he knew he was being filmed. I think that literally forced us to all deal with our humanity. And because of that, I think it has actually ignited something in us to say, wait a minute, we're just better than this. We cannot just sit back and allow this to happen. And so I do believe that there's been a political turning point in this country. Where that goes, I think we will determine that. That people, what I am seeing in Portland, when I'm looking at thousands, the Wall of Moms, when I'm looking at thousands of women come together and say, and it was one, you know, one interview where I heard a woman said, when George Floyd called his mama, he was calling all of us, you know, and so I thought that was so powerful and profound because that's how I felt. And then so to see these women actually make a lullaby out of a resistance song, I mean, I just think that it is profound because I think that this isn't just about another action. I don't think this isn't about another law just to arrest someone is another law. I think what has been pierced is our humanity, and we want to see something different. We no longer want to continue to go on this road. And so I do think that we're in a very, very different time. I do think that there has been a shift to happen. The question now is, how will we respond to this in the long term?
Right. I mean, starting with, of course, you know, the November election and getting rid of Trump. But you're right. I think it is sort of a change of consciousness that even maybe Trump's, no pun intended, you know, any one piece of legislation, it's, you know, because pollsters have said they've never seen public opinion on virtually anything, especially in these polarizing times. They've never seen it move so quickly, you know, in terms of people supporting Black Lives Matter and all of that, right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, but when we see it, and while I think that one event was the tipping point, I think this has been an accumulation. Mm-hmm. Over the years, we've seen it. Like, how many have to die? We saw Philando Castro. We saw the Castillo. We saw Michael Brown. We saw Trayvon Martin, Breonna Taylor. So it's just ongoing. Sandra Bland is ongoing. And at some point, for anybody, at some point, enough is enough. And I think what we're hearing from the Black community, but I think that what we're hearing from the majority of Americans is that this is not who we want to continue to be, that we want more from this country. We want more from ourselves, and that we want more in the space around safety and security, and that the police does not become a weapon of racial dominance, continues to be a weapon of racial dominance and pain and trauma in our communities. And so what gives me hope are the people. When I am talking to people, when I am watching the uprisings, when I am seeing the women in Portland, seeing the lullabies, when I'm seeing folks in small rural counties stand up with signs saying defund the police or we need better housing, that is the thing that makes real democracy be real.
Well, perfect segue when you mentioned particularly the rural voters. Let's talk about Black Voters Matter. One of the things you're doing is targeting rural Black voters. And, you know, this is interesting and a much-needed approach, I think. I've had a couple of other guests on the show, like Jane Klebb, who's the chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party, and she's the one who led the fight against the Keystone Pipeline and got a lot of rural voters on her side. And she wrote a book called Harvest the Vote, which is about Democrats winning back rural voters. But I think in her case, you know, she's in Nebraska, she's in the middle of America. You know, when people say rural voters, they're thinking Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, that kind of middle America. But of course, you know, there are plenty of African-American rural voters, particularly in the South. And so, you know, it seems to me you're drilling down on that and trying to get to people who don't vote that often and maybe don't get any attention from many or any politicians or campaigns. Can you give us some specifics on that and how to reach some of these rural African-American voters and any numbers on that potential voting block who might not have voted in the last few elections?
Absolutely. A lot of the work that we do at Black Voters Matter is based, is focused on the Black Belt. That's the region that stretches all the way from North Carolina all the way down to Mississippi. That usually it goes through the center of most of those states. And while you have major urban centers, like in Georgia, you've got Atlanta, you've got Charleston in South Carolina, you've got Birmingham in Alabama. The truth of the matter is you've got these large swaths of rural communities that have sizable Black populations of 40% or more. In some areas as high as, like in Macon County, as 70%, 40% or more. And because they're in these rural isolated communities, oftentimes they're underinvested. Those communities are underinvested and they're isolated or marginalized. What we have been focused on is how do we build a pipeline of building power, not just in urban and metro centers, but also in the rural communities. So we go where our people are. That's where we are. And so what we've been doing is working and building a network throughout the Black Belt region in those rural communities because a lot of the work that we're doing is building power from the ground up, not the top down, so that the local school boards, when we're talking about police violence, who hires the police? The local city council or the county commissioner hires the police or the sheriff.
Right.
When we're talking about school local control, that's the local school board. So when we're really talking about power, we really cannot overlook that those communities that have been marginalized need power so that they can actually be more of the decision-making process. And so that's what we've focused on. And so we've been investing in community Black-led grassroots groups in those areas. One of the pieces that I'll lift up is if you go back and look at the Doug Jones-Roy Moore race, which was a United Senate seat that came open in 2017 that was vacated by Jeff Sessions, who fought unsuccessfully to try to secure it again this year.
Yeah.
That particular seat had been a traditional Republican seat. And for the last 20 something years. Well, Alabama shocked America because that seat actually flipped. The Senate seat flipped in a very conservative, a deeply red and conservative state. How was that the case? It was the case because you had an overperformance of Black voters. And guess where the highest performing Black voters were? They were actually in the Black Belt region, not in the cities. The cities, it was a high performance as well, but the Black voters in the rural communities actually outperformed. And so I raised, there's a lot of potential that is sitting in rural America. I don't think just even with Black voters, there's an assumption that all white voters that live in rural America are wearing MAGNA hats. That is not, folks, we've been talking to folks, that's not the case.
Right.
You know, there is a sizable a growing diversity in many of these rural areas, particularly like in Arkansas and some of the other states. My point is that we have a particular political paradigm that does not acknowledge that America, the demographics in America are shifting. Right. That even in some communities, because of the rise in housing rates in these urban centers and these cities, that people have been pushed to go back and to live in rural communities or suburban communities. And so because of that, what we want to do, that as America shifts and grows, we want to take advantage of that so that we're all building power, not just in the city centers, but that all citizens are able to build power, particularly in the rural areas where there's such a great need around, from rural hospitals closing to issues around education to the economic drain and the brain drain on those communities. And so we believe that part of our philosophy is going where there is the greatest need, but also where there is tremendous potential.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's all about generating grassroots activity and enthusiasm and getting people involved, not just in election years just to vote, but to connecting those votes to some of the issues that you started to mention there, like with hospitals, rural hospitals, and that sort of thing. Is that the idea? You get them involved so that they're active participants throughout, not just in, one election day.
Oh, absolutely. And some of it is, some people are already involved. They need resources to be able to expand the work that they're doing. So in many of these communities, what we found, there's already organizations that have been doing the work, but they've been doing the work without having resources to expand what they're doing, without having resources to expand their message. And so what we do is we come in and help them build their capacity, because they're the ones that live in that community. They're the ones that know what their community needs. That's how you build power. You build power. I mean, we all learn that in poli sci. For some reason, we forget it. But in poli sci 101, the first thing they teach you is all politics are local. Mm-hmm. Yet when you look at investment, there's often very few resources that goes to the political empowerment in local communities, and particularly when they're in rural communities. So some of the criticism, if we're going to be honest, some of the criticism that, voters have had, even with the Democratic Party, around the overlooking of rural areas, some of that is true. But it's not just the overlooking of white rural communities, there's also the overlooking of people of color in those areas. And so there's potential. I think there's untapped potential. I actually wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a year ago that was specifically around the untapped potential of rural America. That when you look at the numbers, there's a tremendous amount of changes and growth. While rural America continues to be majority white, rural white, that when you look at the demographic shifts, that you look at, there's power and potential that exists in rural America. And even rural whites, I think we put all rural white people in a particular kind of bag or box as if they're all highly conservative Republicans. That is not the case. There's a tremendous amount of potential, but those communities cannot continue to be ignored. They've got to be engaged and supported in their own empowerment.
Well, and you demonstrated, as you mentioned, with the Alabama Senate race in 2017, the power of the ballot box, at least when you do engage those populations. I assume, obviously, Doug Jones running for re-election this November in Alabama, I assume you'll be active and are active trying to get out the vote there again, correct? And what other states are you zoning in on for November specifically?
So we're working on the states that we're working in, Alabama, Mississippi, working in all the good states.
All right.
The states, and other people like, why are you working there? Because, a lot of times what we hear, and I'll share the states, a lot of times people will say, why are you working in those states? They're red. I say, yeah, they're red until they ain't. Right.
Well,
at the end of the day, they're Republican until they're no longer Republican.
Well, this is why this is why I love having you on the podcast, because this podcast is all about how Democrats can win more in red states. So this is you're telling
absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There we go.
Like you're part of what we're doing is we're literally what I say leaving apples on the tree. That there is a tremendous amount of potential. Those communities have been so marginalized and overlooked that, I will take our first race. I'll give an example beyond even Alabama. The very first race that when we established Black Voters Matter in 2016, we worked in was a state House seat in rural Georgia. And in that House seat, when we looked at the numbers, we couldn't understand where there were Democratic leaning voters, why a Republican was holding that seat. So we went down in that area. My partner, Cliff Albright, who is the co-founder and my business partner, and Black Voters Matter, and is, serves as executive director. We talked to people and were trying to figure out, and folks had all kinds of reasons. Oh, the guy who holds that seat, he was a local principal and he knows everybody. And then we would hear other folks and Democrats, people who were in the party would say, well, yeah, it's hard to beat him and X, Y, Z. And we would look at him like, other than Jesus, why are y'all acting like he's, other than Jesus, he can be beat. So I don't understand why you just abdicated power. Like, this is a seat, the numbers don't lie.
Right.
And literally, we made an investment of less than $2,000. I need you to hear what I'm saying. Less than $2,000. Work with an organization down in that area. And you know what happened? Captured that seat. What was the significance of capturing that one seat? That one seat kept the Republicans of the state of Georgia from having a supermajority. Mm. They had a majority, but they didn't have a supermajority. I'm raising that because sometimes we're so busy on looking for, it's almost like, don't let perfect be the killer of good. Yeah. That sometimes we're looking for these dramatic, large wins that we're literally leaving right apples on the tree in these rural areas where we can actually go and pick up seats and gain power. And in many of these rural areas where they have a significant population that are Democratic leaning voters, what we often see is that only time that they'll see really around support is if there is a really hotly contested party race that the state party or the national party cares about, but not a lot of investment in the local races. The problem is it's hard for people to get excited about voting for president or voting for a U.S. senator when they've lost control of their school board. Mm-hmm. That's where they feel the most. When they've lost control of picking the sheriff that they want, when they've lost control of their county commissioner, when they've lost control of their city council. The point is, when you show up, what we have seen, and we have the receipts to prove it. When we show up for people, people show up for us. And so ultimately, we have to show up. And that's our model. Our model is when we go into communities, we don't tell them what races that they've got to support or whatever. They tell us what we literally have a conversation with them around. What kind of power are you trying to build? And where do you see that? And who do you need to be in a position to have that power? Mm. Some communities may say, we need the DA race. And guess what we do? We invest in them on our C4 side to help them really be able to get a DA. And we know the difference. We've seen it, that having a DA, a one DA can make a difference between whether that community sees sentences of 20 years or 5 years. Like the ultimate, the bottom line is, part of what is not happening is we're not strengthening the foundation of the Democratic base and engage them in a way that you can build upon there. That's a lot of untapped potential that we're simply not utilizing.
Yeah, and when you mention how far a small amount of money like $2,000 can go in a key, what turns out to be at the local level, at least, or the state level, a key race. I mean, that's been a theme too on this podcast. I have some other people that are doing some grassroots stuff at the state level. And it's like all the, as you said, the presidential election or a big Senate race gets all the attention, but your dollars can sometimes go a lot further just by investing in some of these smaller races or grassroots activity like you're talking about.
Absolutely, that actually has a larger impact. Mm-hmm. For example, if people know there's a major distinction of power between having a majority and a supermajority of a party.
That's right.
Right. And so that one seat, that was captured for less than a few thousand dollars made that difference. And I think sometimes we have to be more strategic. One, I mean, I am, and I guess this is the pink in the brain in me. I think we should be going after every seat.
Yes.
Why are we like not going after every seat? I mean, I think this whole strategy of let's just go after the seats we can win. You know, the bottom line is then when will you take the risk to really be able to shift power? The truth of the matter is when we're looking in, let's wake up America. You know, we're looking at the rural South. Well, let me just say this. Who's running America right now? The South is running America right now. Mm-hmm. Who is running the Senate? Where's Mitch McConnell from? Mm-hmm. Where's Lindsey Graham from? I'm raising that with Jeff Sessions, with the Attorney General. Where's he from? They're from Kentucky, South Carolina, and Alabama. And guess what? They are making the decision on the agenda of what bills come up. They're making a decision around what gets through the Senate. They're making a decision on the policy priorities for all of America. So it doesn't matter how blue you are in New York or how blue you are in California. Ultimately, your fate is being decided by the folks that we're trying to fight in these areas. So it is in our vested interests that we do not allow the South to continue to be the breeding ground and the base of the reactionary, racist Republican Party.
You're talking my language. This is the this is the point I'm making, and the fact that in a number of these states, the population numbers are such that you can win races by a shift of not that large a number of voters. I mean, I appreciated Beto O'Rourke and trying to flip Texas and everything, but in some of these, he had to move 1 million votes in order to try to win that race. Whereas you get some of these other smaller states where the numbers aren't that huge, and like I said, a few thousand votes makes a difference. And so that's where the grassroots investment really helps too, getting more of these voters out or persuading a few more people. And suddenly you're winning more races, or at least more competitive. So I'm with you 100%. Before I let you go, I want to just quickly touch on voter ID laws for a second. I think a lot of people who maybe just casually follow politics and, certainly those who are interested in the U.S. political system but maybe live in another country, they don't really understand the specifics of why voter ID laws sort of fall under the category of voter suppression. They think, what's the big deal? Just show up and bring your ID. So can you just kind of give a quick thumbnail explanation of why these voter ID laws, often put in by Republicans, of course, end up suppressing the minority vote?
It's interesting. I think what we saw, it's like a playbook. It's so frustrating because those of us in 2013 who had actually traveled to the Supreme Court to advocate and to beg that we did not need the stripping of the Voting Rights Act. Right. That in fact, what we were going to see is we're going to see these voter ID laws and these others. And some people say, well, that's just kind of, it's a vote, just get an ID. Well, let's say around some of the problems that people that we've been talking to, women, a lot of times, particularly in these areas, you've got women who are married, women who are married that have an ID based on the maiden name and they may have not switched over. We're in the middle of a COVID crisis right now, really be able, and a lot of the driver's license places have been closed. Really just some logistically, it's just an additional added burden around going to get a voter ID. And some of these, are getting the ID, a state ID. And in many of these places, having an identification that was valid identification wasn't enough. They would make it so specific, knowing that each time they created that kind of criteria, it make it a little bit more difficult for folks. For example, there are certain folks, even in my own family, that in the Deep South, that the record of their birth was a notation in the Bible. Like they were born at home in with a midwife, or they may not have a documentation to say, particularly the elders in our community. So now you're punishing elders in our community because you are literally seeking to suppress the vote. The bottom line is anything that puts on an additional burden, whether that's an additional cost and an additional cost, whether that is creating any kind of additional burden for people to have free and fair access to the ballot, is a form of voter suppression. And what happens is we kind of minimize it because we come from a place of privilege. Those of us that have transportation, those of us that have the documentation, those of us that have the money that they can spend on getting an ID, let's say they lost it, those of us all of those things are places of privilege. We may not see that, but they are. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is what's behind that is that what the Republicans know is like a death by 1,000 cuts. If we shave off a couple of votes here, if we shave off a few here and a few here, ultimately, accumulatively, what we've done is we've shaved off thousands of votes, created additional barriers for folks. And ultimately, because we know, particularly in Black communities, particularly in the rural South, just access, transportation is a major barrier.
Yeah.
So all of those things, I think, add into it's not just as simple as, oh, everybody can get a voter ID. Because for some, getting the ID is much more difficult than for others.
Yeah, we've heard stories of people being in like rural Texas or wherever, and the nearest government office where they even can even get the ID is like 100 miles away. And like you said, there's issues of transportation and cost and all of that. So yeah, it's a strategy to just make people not bother to vote. And obviously we know who it's designed to suppress. So appreciate the explanation there. By the way, you did in the 2018 midterms, you did I think it was like the Blackest Bus in America tour or whatever. Are you doing that again for the 2020 election? Where are you going if you are?
We've kind of technically put the bus down. We actually brought her out this weekend. We were part of the motorcade for John Lewis, Representative John Lewis Memorial and Homegoing. We felt because of our work is so shaped by the foundational work that he's done, that we actually brought the bus, we traveled to Selma because we wanted to participate and be a part of bearing witness of his last trip across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And we've used it in very extraordinary circumstances. For example, we did go in Kentucky with the Blackest Bus in America because it brings such energy and excitement. But we're also being very mindful that we're still in the midst of a health pandemic, and that in our community, we have to be safe, and we don't want to do anything that is literally counterintuitive to really being able to have crowds of folks. We're not trying to do that right now because we really care about the health and safety and well-being of our community. So right now, we don't have any plans of doing a bus tour. We do have plans in terms of making the bus be a virtual bus. So nice. Doing a virtual bus tour. So we're just being creative in how we do it. But what's most important to us is that people are able to participate in this election cycle, but that people and communities stay healthy, that the health and well-being of our communities is very important for us. So we're moving around a little bit different in 2020, unfortunately, but fortunately in the sense that we care about people.
Absolutely. And that's everybody's had to adjust. So, you're not alone on that. Before I let you go, just we're having this conversation. Joe Biden has not yet selected his running mate. I was just curious if you had a preference. It really does seem like the shortlist is almost exclusively African-American women at this point. We know it's going to be a woman. There's no way it's going to be a white woman. Do you have a preference or any thoughts on who would be your choice, who he selects?
Well, I'm glad. I think you're more optimistic than I am. That is to hear that, I'm not convinced that it's not going to be, that it's going to be a woman of color just quite yet. I'm just not. But I am certainly, that is what I am standing for. I am standing for that there's no way that Black women have been the most consistent base of the Democratic Party for the last 50 years, that we have showed up and showed out in ways, and even Biden to be the lead candidate is because of the work that Black women did and helping to secure and turn that election around. So I think that the list and the names that have been brought up are all wonderfully qualified women. And I just want to see him do the right thing and select a Black woman as his VP.
Nice. Very diplomatic, but I agree with you. I think he will. I'm optimistic, so we'll find out soon enough.
I hope you're right.
Latasha Brown, thanks for joining me on the podcast today. Appreciate the work you're doing. It's great grassroots, grinded out voter mobilization. If you want to get involved, you can go to BlackVotersMatterFund.org. That's the main organization that Latasha co-founded. Check them out. Thanks again, Latasha, for taking the time to join me here on Clusterfuck. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day. Thank you.
Okay. There it is. Black voters matter. African-American women are really the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. You get a really good sense from talking to Latasha about all the good work they do at the grassroots level. If you want to follow Latasha on Twitter, it's @Ms. Latasha Brown, and @BlackVotersMTR, short for matter, @BlackVotersMTR. And as I mentioned, BlackVotersMatterFund.org is the website of the organization that Latasha co-founded. Doing good stuff. Twitter, I always mention you can follow me as well. The Civil Liberal is my moniker, but the handle is @CFThePodcast. And please visit CFThePodcast.com for further episodes of this program. There's also information about the program there, and you can sign up for our mailing list. That's a good way to keep in touch. We update people on when the episodes are released and all that. This program is available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, all the fine podcatchers, but we love it when you visit cfthepodcast.com. And you can support the podcast there, too. It's a labor of love, as I always say. I've got no big financial backer, no major advertiser. You don't hear any commercials. So it's coming from me. But we do have some expenses. We're recording at the lovely studio, dbaudio.ca. And we've got web hosting and audio hosting and some other marketing things. Occasionally, more than occasionally, a bill comes in. So if you want to support the podcast, we appreciate it. And as I say, go to cfthepodcast.com, click on support the podcast, and you'll figure out the easy way to do that. And you can find us on Facebook as well. Just do a little search for CF the Podcast. Like the page. We post articles and other things related to, you know, the things that we talk about on this fine program. And I've also started a Facebook group called Red State Democrats, where we discuss what's going on in the various red state races and how Democrats are doing. And we've got some candidates in there and campaign stuff in there. It's kind of a fun place to be. So you can also do a search for Red State Democrats on Facebook. Anyway, appreciate you taking the time to listen.
The Clusterfuck Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
This is Roger King. That'll be all.